Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, new weather information shows the Arctic just had its warmest winter on record. The same information also shows that sea ice hit record lows for this time of year. That means there is plenty of open water in the Arctic Ocean, where ocean water normally freezes into thick pieces of ice. Scientists told the Associated Press, "What is happening now has never happened before." They say it is part of a vicious cycle, a series of cause and effect events in Earth's atmosphere. The scientists believe that climate change could be fueling these changes. They say slowly rising temperatures in the atmosphere are likely influencing strong, icy storms in Europe and the northeastern United States. "It's just crazy, crazy stuff," said Mark Zarez, director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. Zarez has been studying the Arctic since 1982. "These heat waves, I've never seen anything like this," he said. "This past winter has been so warm that the land weather station closest to the North Pole, at the top of Greenland, spent more than 60 hours above freezing last month." Before this year, scientists had only seen temperatures there briefly rise above freezing in February only two times before. On February 24, 2018, the temperature at the top of Greenland reached 6 degrees Celsius, setting a record for that date. The warmer weather reached other parts of the Arctic Circle. In Barrow, Alaska, the temperature in February was 10 degrees warmer than normal. All winter long, the average temperatures were 7.8 degrees Celsius higher than normal. At over 30 different Arctic weather stations, 15 of them were at least 5.6 degrees Celsius above normal for the winter. That information comes from climate scientist Brian Brettschneider of the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Weather scientists consider December, January, and February to be winter. Arctic weather stations averaged 4.9 degrees Celsius higher than normal for the season that just ended. The air above the Chukchi and Bering Seas near Alaska averaged about 11 degrees Celsius higher than normal for February, the data center reported. In February, Arctic sea ice covered 13.9 million square kilometers. This is about 160,000 square kilometers less than the record low last year, the ICE data center said. Sea ice coverage in February also was 1.4 million square kilometers below the 30-year average. That represents an area nearly two times the size of the state of Texas. Sea ice is frozen ocean water that forms, grows, and melts on the ocean. Near Greenland, warm air moved north over part of the Atlantic Ocean that usually has sea ice. Something similar was also happening in the Pacific Ocean, creating open water on normally frozen parts of the Bering Sea, said data center scientist Walt Meyer. To be happening on opposite sides of the Arctic at the same time is unusual, he added. While some natural weather systems were involved, climate change is the most important influence, Meyer said. When you have warmer temperatures, you are going to melt more ice, and it's going to grow more slowly.
This year's top award in architecture goes to Balkrishna Doshi. This is the first time an Indian has won in the 40-year history of the award, known as the Pritzker Prize. Some compare the award to the Nobel Prize. Doshi has been an architect, city planner, and educator for 70 years. In contrast to other Pritzker winners, Doshi works almost only in his home country. In Ahmedabad, Doshi's designs can be seen in the concrete Life Insurance Corporation housing buildings to the flowing curves of the Ahmedabad Nigufna Art Gallery. But he is best known for designing low-cost housing. The Aranya project in Indore is home to more than 80,000 people, many of them poor. It includes a system of houses, courtyards, and pathways. Doshi says the housing can change how homeowners see their world. Now, their life has been changed. They feel hopeful, he said. They have ownership of something. Doshi said his life's work has been to help the have-nots, the people who have nothing. He called the prize an honor both for himself and for India. Doshi was born in 1927 in the city of Pune. He studied architecture in Mumbai and later worked under the architect known as Le Corbusier. Doshi was the first director of Ahmedabad's School of Architecture and Planning, now known as SEPT University. He founded his own company in 1956 and lives and works in Ahmedabad. The Hyatt Foundation, which sponsors the Pritzker Prize, called Doshi's work poetic and functional. It noted that Doshi's buildings both respect Eastern culture and improve the quality of life in India. My work is the story of my life, Doshi said in the award announcement. He said he was always moving forward, changing and searching, to look beyond architecture, to look only at life. Doshi will be given the $100,000 prize in May at a ceremony in Toronto, Canada. I'm Susan Shand.
Among today's hottest-selling personal technology devices are smart digital assistants for the home. Google Home, Amazon Echo, and Apple HomePod are all artificial intelligence, or AI-powered systems that respond to voice commands. The systems connect to the internet to look up information, play music or movies, or control household devices. Now, researchers have developed the first AI assistant for use in space. European aerospace company Airbus cooperated with US-based IBM on the system. It will be deployed to the International Space Station, or ISS, during a mission in June. Airbus says it is the first time an AI system will be used aboard the ISS. The assistant is called Simon, which stands for Crew Interactive Mobile Companion. It is a round device weighing about 5 kilograms. It is designed to move around by itself and follow the movements of humans. It has a computer-like display in front for showing many kinds of information. An official from Airbus describes it as a kind of flying brain designed to support astronauts in their daily work. The digital brain is powered by IBM's AI processing system called Watson. Just like digital assistants for the home, Simon uses AI to learn and predict human behaviors from repeated interactions over time. The system is trained to recognize voices and faces so it can respond directly with people. Simon will be tested by German astronaut Alexander Gerst during the European Space Agency's upcoming Horizons mission aboard the ISS from June to October. Gerst will command the space station during the second half of the mission. Flight tests will be carried out before the mission to make sure Simon operates correctly in conditions of weightlessness. Gerst will perform 3 specific experiments with Simon. One will examine the effects of space on crystals. He will also team up with Simon to solve a Rubik's Cube. A 3rd medical experiment will use Simon as a smart flying camera. The researchers say these experiments are just a start. They hope to use Simon to interact and assist astronauts on many future missions. They especially see the system as an important safety tool that can provide early warning signs of technical problems in space that may not be seen by ground controllers. Till Eisenberg is one of Airbus's lead researchers on the project. He says in addition to providing the crew with important information and instructions, the system will closely observe astronaut behavior. "We want to study the psychological effects of long space missions on crew members and try out suitable countermeasures, especially those that reduce stress," Eisenberg said. In another space tech development, it was recently announced that the Moon will be getting its own mobile 4G phone network. The new network, a project between Vodafone Germany and Nokia, will be in place sometime next year, the companies say. The question many people are asking is, why is such a network even needed on the Moon? The answer: 2019 is the year the first privately financed mission to the moon is set to launch. The Mission to the Moon project is being led by Germany's PT scientists. The group has promised to launch a moon lander and two small rovers aboard a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket next year. Vodafone officials say the special space-grade mobile network will only require a small piece of equipment weighing less than 1 kilogram. The company says the network should allow two moon vehicles designed by German automaker Audi to communicate and send scientific data and HD video back to Earth. The head of Germany's PT scientists, Robert Böhme, said the private moon project marks an important first step for new exploration of the solar system in years to come. In order for humanity to leave the cradle of Earth, we need to develop infrastructures beyond our home planet. With Mission to the Moon, we will establish and test the first elements of a dedicated communications network on the moon. Next year's planned mission comes exactly 50 years after the first American astronauts landed their Apollo 11 spacecraft and became the first humans to walk on the moon. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The American Civil War in the 1860s was fought not only on land. There was a great deal of fighting between the Union and Confederate navies. This part of the war, the Sea War, is often forgotten, but it was important. The Union victory might not have been possible without the successes of its navy. Many battles took place just off the coast of the United States. Many others took place farther away, in international waters. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe talk about the naval side of the Civil War.
As soon as the war started, President Abraham Lincoln wanted to block the South's major ports. He wanted to prevent the South from shipping its agricultural products to other countries in exchange for industrial goods. Lincoln's plan was good, but it had one major weakness. The Union Navy was too small for the job. The Confederate seacoast was long. It extended from Chesapeake Bay to Mexico, a distance of 5,600 kilometers. There were not enough ships in the Union Navy to blockade all of it. Many months would pass before the Union could build up an effective naval force.
The Confederacy had no navy at the start of the Civil War. The Confederate government had little money to create one, and the South had no factories to build one. For a while, the Confederacy was able to get warships from Britain. Then the Union put diplomatic pressure on Britain to stop this support. For the most part, the Confederacy depended on privately owned ships to get goods in and out of the South. About 20 of these private ships flew the Confederate flag. Most were very successful in the beginning. The Florida, for example, captured more than 30 ships before being captured itself off the coast of Brazil in 1864. The Alabama captured more than 60 ships. It was finally sunk in a battle with the Kearsarge off the coast of France. The Shenandoah sailed in the Pacific Ocean. It captured 40 ships. After the war ended, the Shenandoah tied up in Liverpool, England.
In addition to these victories, the Confederacy claimed responsibility for several new naval technologies during the Civil War. One was the first modern submarine. This ship was 10 meters long. It sank 4 times while being tested. It was raised each time and put back into service. One night, it fired its torpedoes at a much larger Union ship and sank it. But the explosion was so great that it tore apart the submarine, and it sank too. The Confederacy also developed very effective underwater explosive devices for use in the harbors.
Even with its victories and technologies, however, the Confederacy could not stop the Union Navy. The Union Navy was bigger to begin with and grew much faster. During the first 2 years of the Civil War, the Union captured several southern ports, Fort Hatteras and Roanoke Island, North Carolina, Port Royal, South Carolina, Pensacola, Florida, and perhaps most importantly, New Orleans, Louisiana. New Orleans lay near the mouth of the Mississippi River. It was the largest city in the South. It was the largest seaport. It had become a busy industrial center, producing war equipment for Confederate forces. If the Union could capture New Orleans, it would control the Mississippi River. President Lincoln appointed Navy officer David Farragut to lead the attack on New Orleans.
To reach the city, Farragut had to sail his ships past 2 Confederate forts on the Mississippi River. He shelled the forts for 6 days and nights, but the forts were so strong that the shells caused little damage. He decided not to wait any longer. One dark night, Farragut led 17 Union warships up the river in a line. The Confederate forces heard them and began to fire. One ship was sunk. 3 others were damaged so badly that they could not continue. But 13 made it safely past the forts. When Farragut reached New Orleans, he found the city defenseless. Several thousand Confederate soldiers had fled. They knew they could not defend against the bigger Union force. Only civilians remained. Farragut captured New Orleans without a fight. The Confederate flag was lowered, and the United States flag was raised over the city.
Several weeks before Farragut captured New Orleans, a new kind of Navy battle was fought off Hampton Roads, Virginia. It was the first battle between iron ships. On the Confederate side was the Virginia. It had been built from what remained of a captured Union warship called the Merrimack. The Virginia was like no other warship ever seen in the world. It was 80 meters long. The part that showed above the waterline was built of wood 60 centimeters thick. This part was covered with sheets of iron 10 centimeters thick. 10 windows were cut into it. Behind each window was a cannon. In a battle, the windows would open, the cannons would fire, and the windows would close again. At the front was a sharp point of iron that could smash through the sides of wooden ships. The Virginia could not move fast, and it was difficult to control. It took almost 30 minutes to turn around. Still, there seemed to be no way to stop this iron monster. It already had destroyed 2 Union warships, and it was coming back for more.
The Union ship chosen to fight the Virginia was the Monitor. It, too, was covered with iron, but it was much smaller than the Virginia, and it carried only 2 cannons. These 2 cannons, however, were on a part of the ship that could turn in a complete circle. They could be aimed in any direction. The Monitor and the Virginia faced each other on the morning of March 9th, 1862. They moved in close, very close, then began to fire. A Confederate cannonball hit the iron side of the Monitor and bounced away. Union sailors cheered. The cannons of the Virginia could do no damage. But the Union sailors soon discovered that their cannons could do no damage either.
The men inside the 2 ships suffered from noise, heat, and smoke. The roar of their own cannons was extremely loud. Even louder was the crash of enemy cannonballs and explosive shells on the iron walls. Some of the men suffered burst eardrums. At least one man was struck unconscious from the force of a cannonball against the iron. The men quickly learned to stay away from the walls. Smoke from the cannons filled the ships. Then it floated out over the water. At times, the 2 ships could not see each other.
The Virginia and the Monitor fought for 3 hours. Neither ship scored an important hit. Neither suffered serious damage. Then the cannons of the Virginia fell silent. The Confederate ship had used up its gunpowder. It also had used up much of its fuel. It was lighter now and was floating higher in the water. A well-aimed cannonball could hit below its iron covering and sink it. The Confederate captain decided to withdraw. The Union captain, too, was ready to break off the battle. He decided not to follow. Neither ship could claim victory. But the Monitor had kept the Virginia from destroying more of the Union's wooden warships. The Virginia itself was to live just 2 more months. Union forces seized the Confederate Navy base at Norfolk, where the Virginia was kept. And the Iron Monster was sunk to keep it from falling into Union hands.
The battle at Hampton Roads between the Virginia and the Monitor was indecisive. It did not have much effect on the final result of America's Civil War. But it was still an important battle, for it marked the beginning of the end of the world's wooden navies.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.